Chapter 2. The Welcome. The halls of Faldara Keep, their smooth stone walls sparsely decorated with elegantly simple tapestries and painted screens, bustled with news of the Ammerlin Seat's imminent arrival. Servants in black and gold darted about their tasks, running to prepare rooms or carry orders to the kitchens, moaning that they could not have everything ready for so great a personage when they had had no warning. Dark-eyed warriors, their heads shaven except for a topknot bound with a leather cord, did not run, but haste filled their steps, and their faces shone with an excitement normally reserved for battle. Some of the men spoke as Rand hurried past.
"Ah, there you are, Randalthor. Peace favor your sword. On your way to clean up? You'll want to look your best when you're presented to the Ammerlin Seat. She'll want to see you and your two friends as well as the women. You can count on it."
He trotted toward the broad stairs, wide enough for 20 men abreast, that led up to the men's apartments.
"The Ammerlin herself, come with no more warning than a pack peddler. Must be because of Moraine Sedai and you southerners, eh? What else?"
The wide, iron-bound doors of the men's apartments stood open and half-jammed with top-knotted men buzzing with the Ammerlin's arrival.
"Ho, Southlander! The Ammerlin's here! Come for you and your friends, I suppose. Peace, what honor for you! She seldom leaves Tarvalen, and she's never come to the Borderlands in my memory."
He fended them all off with a few words. He had to wash, find a clean shirt, no time to talk. They thought they understood and let him go. Not a one of them knew a thing except that he and his friends traveled in company with an Aes Sedai, that two of his friends were women who were going to Tarvalen to train as Aes Sedai, but their words stabbed at him as if they knew everything.
"She's come for me."
He dashed through the men's apartments, darted into the room he shared with Matt and Perrin, and froze, his jaw dropping in astonishment. The room was filled with women wearing the black and gold, all working purposefully. It was not a big room, and its windows, a pair of tall, narrow arrow slits looking down on one of the inner courtyards, did nothing to make it seem larger. 3 beds on black and white tiled platforms, each with a chest at the foot, 3 plain chairs, a washstand by the door, and a tall, wide wardrobe crowded the room. The 8 women in there seemed like fish in a basket. The women barely glanced at him and went right on clearing his clothes, and Matt and Perrin's, out of the wardrobe and replacing them with new. Anything found in the pockets was put atop the chests, and the old clothes were bundled up carelessly like rags.
"What are you doing?" he demanded when he caught his breath. "Those are my clothes."
One of the women sniffed and poked a finger through a tear in the sleeve of his only coat, then added it to the pile on the floor. Another, a black-haired woman with a big ring of keys at her waist, set her eyes on him. That was Elansu, Chatayan of the Keep. He thought of the sharp-faced woman as a housekeeper, though the house she kept was a fortress and scores of servants did her bidding.
"Moraine Sedai said all of your clothes are worn out, and the Lady Amalisa had new made to give you. Just keep out of our way," she added firmly, "and we will be done the quicker."
There were a few men the Chatayan could not bully into doing as she wished. Some said even Lord Agelmar, and she plainly did not expect any trouble with one man young enough to be her son. He swallowed what he had been going to say. There was no time for arguing. The Ammerlin Seat could be sending for him at any minute.
"Honor to the Lady Amalisa for her gift," he managed, after the Shinaran way. "And honor to you, Elansu Chatayan. Please convey my words to the Lady Amalisa, and tell her I said, heart and soul to serve."
That ought to satisfy the Shinaran love of ceremony for both women.
"But now, if you'll pardon me, I want to change."
"That is well,"
Elansu said comfortably.
"Moraine Sedai said to remove all the old, every stitch. Small clothes, too."
Several of the women eyed him sideways. None of them made a move toward the door. He bit his cheek to keep from laughing hysterically. Many ways were different in Shinar from what he was used to, and there were some to which he would never become accustomed if he lived forever. He had taken to bathing in the small hours of the morning, when the big, tiled pools were empty of people, after he discovered that at any other time a woman might climb into the water with him. It could be a scullion or the Lady Amalisa, Lord Agelmar's sister herself. The baths were one place in Shinar where there was no rank. Expecting him to scrub her back in return for the same favor, asking him why his face was so red, had he taken too much sun? They had soon learned to recognize his blushes for what they were, and not a woman in the keep but seemed fascinated by them. I might be dead or worse in another hour, and they're waiting to see me blush. He cleared his throat.
If you'll wait outside, I'll pass the rest out to you. On my honor.
One of the women gave a soft chortle, and even Elansu's lips twitched, but the Shatayan nodded and directed the other women to gather up the bundles they had made. She was the last to leave, and she paused in the doorway to add,
"The boots, too. Moraine Sadai said everything."
He opened his mouth, then closed it again. His boots, at least, were certainly still good, made by Alwyn Alvan, the cobbler back in Emmons Field, and well broken in and comfortable. But if giving up his boots would make the Shatayan leave him alone so he could go, he would give her the boots and anything else she wanted. He had no time.
"Yes, yes, of course. On my honor."
He pushed on the door, forcing her out. Alone, he dropped onto his bed to tug off his boots. They were still good, a little worn, the leather cracked here and there, but still wearable and well broken in to fit his feet. Then hastily stripped off, piling everything atop the boots, and washed at the basin just as quickly. The water was cold. The water was always cold in the men's apartments. The wardrobe had three wide doors carved in the simple Shinaran manner, suggesting more than showing a series of waterfalls and rocky pools. Pulling open the center door, he stared for a moment at what had replaced the few garments he had brought with him. A dozen high-collared coats of the finest wool, and as well-cut as any he had ever seen on a merchant's back or a lord's, most embroidered like feast-day clothes. A dozen. Three shirts for every coat, both linen and silk, with wide sleeves and tight cuffs. Two cloaks. Two, when he had made do with one at a time all his life. One cloak was plain, stout wool and dark green, the other deep blue with a stiff-standing collar embroidered in gold with herons. And high on the left breast, where a lord would wear his sign, his hand drifted to the cloak of its own accord. As if uncertain what they would feel, his fingers brushed the stitching of a serpent, curled almost into a circle, but a serpent with four legs and a lion's golden mane, scaled in crimson and gold, its feet each tipped with five golden claws. His hand jerked back as if burned.
Light, help me. Was it Amalisa had this made, or Moraine? How many saw it? How many know what it is, what it means? Even one is too many. Burn me, she's trying to get me killed. Bloody Moraine won't even talk to me, but now she's given me bloody fine new clothes to die in.
A rap at the door sent him leaping half out of his skin.
Are you done? Came Elansu's voice. Every stitch now. Perhaps I had better...
A creak as if she were trying the knob. With a start, Rand realized he was still naked.
I'm done, he shouted. Peace! Don't come in!
Hurriedly, he gathered up what he had been wearing, boots and all.
I'll bring them!
Hiding behind the door, he opened it just wide enough to shove the bundle into the arms of the Shatayan.
That's everything.
She tried to peer through the gap.
Are you sure? Moraine Sadai said everything. Perhaps I had better just look.
It's everything, he growled. On my honor!
He shouldered the door shut in her face and heard laughter from the other side. Muttering under his breath, he dressed hurriedly. He would not put it past any of them to find some excuse to come bullying in anyway. The gray breeches were snugger than he was used to, but still comfortable, and the shirt with its billowy sleeves was wide enough to satisfy any good wife in Emmons Field on laundry day. The knee-high boots fit as if he had worn them a year. He hoped it was just a good cobbler, and not more Aes Sedai work. All of these clothes would make a pack as big as he was. Yet he had grown used to the comfort of clean shirts again, of not wearing the same breeches day after day until sweat and dirt made them as stiff as his boots, then wearing them still. He took his saddlebags from his chest and stuffed what he could into them, then reluctantly spread the fancy cloak out on the bed and piled a few more shirts and breeches on that. Folded with the dangerous sigil inside and tied with a cord, looped so it could be slung on a shoulder, it looked not much different from the packs he had seen carried by other young men on the road. A peal of trumpets rolled through the arrow slits, trumpets calling the fanfare from outside the walls, trumpets answering from the keep towers.
I'll pick out the stitching when I get a chance, he muttered.
He had seen women picking out embroidery when they had made a mistake or changed their mind on the pattern, and it did not look very hard. The rest of the clothes, most of them, in fact, he stuffed back into the wardrobe. No need to leave evidence of flight to be found by the first person to poke a head in after he went. Still frowning, he knelt beside his bed. The tiled platforms on which the beds rested were stoves, where a small fire damped down to burn all night could keep the bed warm through the worst night in a Shannaran winter. The nights were still cooler than he was used to this time of year, but blankets were enough for warmth now. Pulling open the firebox door, he took out a bundle he could not leave behind. He was glad Elansu had not thought anyone would keep clothes in there. Setting the bundle atop the blankets, he untied one end and partially unfolded it. A gleeman's cloak turned inside out to hide the hundreds of patches that it covered, patches in every size and color imaginable. The cloak itself was sound enough. The patches were a gleeman's badge. Had been a gleeman's badge. Inside nestled two hard leather cases. The larger held a harp, which he never touched. The harp was never meant for a farmer's clumsy fingers, boy. The other, long and slim, contained the gold and silver-chased flute he had used to earn his supper and bed more than once since leaving home. Tom Marilyn had taught him to play that flute before the gleeman died. Rand could never touch it without remembering Tom, with his sharp blue eyes and his long white mustaches, shoving the bundled cloak into his hands and shouting for him to run. And then Tom had to run himself, knives appearing magically in his hands as if he were performing, to face the murdrel that was coming to kill them. With a shiver, he redid the bundle.
It's all over with.
Thinking of the wind on the tower top, he added,
strange things happen this close to the Blight.
He was not sure he believed it, not the way Lan had apparently meant it. In any case, even without the Ammerlin seat, it was past time for him to be gone from Faldara. Shrugging into the coat he had kept out, it was a deep, dark green and made him think of the forests at home, Tam's Westwood farm where he had grown up, and the Waterwood where he had learned to swim. He buckled the Heronmark sword to his waist and hung his quiver, bristling with arrows, on the other side. His unstrung bow stood propped in the corner with mats and perrins, the stave 2 hands taller than he was. He had made it himself since coming to Faldara, and besides him, only Lan and Perrin could draw it. Stuffing his blanket roll and his new cloak through the loops on his bundles, he slung the pair from his left shoulder, tossed his saddlebags atop the cords, and grabbed the bow.
Leave the sword arm free, he thought. Make them think I'm dangerous. Maybe somebody will.
Cracking the door revealed the hall all but empty. One liveried servant dashed by, but he never so much as glanced at Rand. As soon as the man's rapid footfalls faded, Rand slipped out into the corridor. He tried to walk naturally, casually, but with saddlebags on his shoulder and bundles on his back, he knew he looked like what he was, a man setting out on a journey and not meaning to come back. The trumpets called again, sounding fainter here inside the keep. He had a horse, a tall bay stallion, in the north stable, called the Lord's Stable, close by the Sally Gate that Lord Aglemar used when he went riding. Neither the Lord of Faldara nor any of his family would be riding today, though, and the stable might be empty except for the stable boys. There were 2 ways to reach the Lord's Stable from Rand's room. One would take him all the way around the keep, behind Lord Aglemar's private garden, then down the far side and through the farrier's smithy, likewise certainly empty now, to the stable yard. Time enough that way for orders to be given for a search to start before he reached his horse. The other was far shorter. First across the outer courtyard, or even now the Ammerlin's seat was arriving, with another dozen or more Aes Sedai. His skin prickled at the thought. He had had more than enough of Aes Sedai for any sane lifetime. 1 was too many. All the stories said it, and he knew it for fact. But he was not surprised when his feet took him toward the outer courtyard. He would never see legendary Tarvalin, he could not afford that risk, now or ever, but he might catch a glimpse of the Ammerlin seat before he left. That would be as much as seeing a queen.
There can't be anything dangerous in just looking from a distance. I'll keep moving and be gone before she ever knows I was there.
He opened a heavy iron-strapped door onto the outer courtyard and stepped out into silence. People forested the guard walk atop every wall. Top-knotted soldiers and liveried servants, and menials still in their muck, all pressed together cheek by jowl, with children sitting on shoulders to look over their elders' heads or squeezing in to peer around waists and knees. Every archer's balcony was packed like a barrel of apples, and faces even showed in the narrow arrow slits in the walls. A thick mass of people bordered the courtyard like another wall, and all of them watched and waited in silence. He pushed his way along the wall, in front of the smithies and Fletcher's stalls that lined the court. Faldara was a fortress, not a palace, despite its size and grim grandeur, and everything about it served that end, apologizing quietly to the people he jostled. Some looked around with a frown, and a few gave a second stare to his saddlebags and bundles, but none broke the silence. Most did not even bother to look at who had bumped past them. He could easily see over the heads of most of them, enough to make out clearly what was going on in the courtyard. Just inside the main gate, a line of men stood beside their horses, 16 of them. No two wore the same kind of armor or carried the same sort of sword, and none looked like Lan, but Rand did not doubt they were warders. Round faces, square faces, long faces, narrow faces, they all had the look as if they saw things other men did not see, heard things other men did not hear. Standing at their ease, they looked as deadly as a pack of wolves. Only one other thing about them was alike. One and all, they wore the color-shifting cloak he had first seen on Lan, the cloak that often seemed to fade into whatever was behind it. It did not make for easy watching or a still stomach, so many men in those cloaks. A dozen paces in front of the warders, a row of women stood by their horses' heads, the cowls of their cloaks thrown back. He could count them now. 14. 14 Aes Sedai. They must be. Tall and short, slender and plump, dark and fair, hair cut short or long, hanging loose down their backs or braided, their clothes were as different as the warders were, in as many cuts and colors as there were women. Yet they, too, had a sameness, one that was only obvious when they stood together like this. To a woman they seemed ageless. From this distance he would have called them all young, but closer he knew they would be like Moraine. Young-seeming, yet not. Smooth-skinned, but with faces too mature for youth, eyes too knowing.
Closer? Fool? I'm too close already. Burn me, I should have gone the long way.
He pressed on toward his goal, another iron-bound door at the far end of the court, but he could not stop looking. Calmly, the Aes Sedai ignored the onlookers and kept their attention on the curtained palanquin, now in the center of the courtyard. The horses bearing it held as still as if ostlers stood at their harness. But there was only one tall woman beside the palanquin, her face an Aes Sedai's face, and she paid no mind to the horses. The staff she held upright before her with both hands was as tall as she, the gilded flame capping it standing above her eyes. Lord Aggalmar faced the palanquin from the far end of the court, bluff and square and face unreadable. His high-collared coat of dark blue bore the three running red foxes of the House of Jagad, as well as the stooping black hawk of Shinar. Beside him stood Ronan, age-withered but still tall. Three foxes carved from red Avatine topped the tall staff the Shambayan bore. Ronan was Elansu's equal in ordering the keep, Shambayan and Shatayan, but Elansu left little for him except ceremonies and acting as Lord Aggalmar's secretary. Both men's topknots were snow-white. All of them, the warders, the Aes Sedai, the Lord of Faldara, and his Shambayan, stood as still as stone. The watching crowd seemed to hold its breath. Despite himself, Rand slowed. Suddenly Ronan rapped his staff loudly three times in the broad paving stones, calling into the silence,
"Who comes here? Who comes here? Who comes here?"
The woman beside the palanquin tapped her staff three times in reply.
"The Watcher of the Seals, the Flame of Tarvalin, the Amarlin Seat."
"Why should we watch?" Ronan demanded.
"For the hope of humankind," the tall woman replied.
"Against what do we guard?"
"The shadow at noon." How long shall we guard? From rising sun to rising sun, so long as the wheel of time turns.
Aglamar bowed, his white topknot stirring in the breeze.
Haldara offers bread and salt and welcome. Welcome is the Ammerland seat of Haldara, for here is the watch kept, here is the pact maintained. Welcome.
The tall woman drew back the curtain of the palanquin, and the Ammerland seat stepped out. Dark-haired, ageless as all Aes Sedai were ageless, she ran her eyes over the assembled watchers as she straightened. Rand flinched when her gaze crossed him. He felt as if he had been touched, but her eyes passed on and came to rest on Lord Aglamar. A liveried servant knelt at her side with folded towels, steam still rising, on a silver tray. Formerly, she wiped her hands and patted her face with a damp cloth.
I offer thanks for your welcome, my son. May the light illumine House Jagad. May the light illumine Faldara and all her people.
Aglamar bowed again.
You honor us, mother.
It did not sound odd, her calling him son or him calling her mother, though comparing her smooth cheeks to his craggy face made him seem more like her father or even grandfather. She had a presence that more than matched his.
House Jagad is yours. Faldara is yours.
Cheers rose on every side, crashing against the walls of the keep like breaking waves. Shivering, Rand hurried toward the door to safety, careless of whom he bumped into now.
Just your bloody imagination. She doesn't even know who you are. Not yet. Blood and ashes if she did.
He did not want to think of what would have happened if she knew who he was, what he was. What would happen when she finally found out? He wondered if she had had anything to do with the wind atop the tower. Aes Sedai could do things like that. When he pushed through that door and slammed it shut behind him, muting the roar of welcome that still shook the courtyard, he heaved a relieved sigh. The halls here were as empty as the others had been, and he all but ran. Out across a smaller courtyard with a fountain splashing in the center, down yet another corridor, and out into the flagstone stable yard. The Lord's stable itself, built into the wall of the keep, stood tall and long, with big windows here inside the walls, and horses kept on two floors. The smithy across the courtyard stood silent, the farrier and his helpers gone to see the welcome. Tima, the leathery-faced head groom, met him at the wide doors with a deep bow, touching his forehead and then his heart.
Spirit and heart to serve you, my lord. How may Tima serve, my lord?
No warrior's top knot here. Tima's hair sat on his head like an inverted gray bowl. Rand sighed.
For the 100th time, Tima, I am not a lord.
As my lord wishes.
The groom's bow was even lower this time. It was his name that caused the problem, and a similarity. Randall Thor, Alan Mandragoran. For Lan, according to the custom of Malkir, the royal Al, named him king, though he never used it himself. For Rand, Al was just a part of his name, though he heard that once, long ago, before the Two Rivers was called the Two Rivers, it had meant son of. Some of the servants in Faldara Keep, though, had taken it to mean he was a king too, or at least a prince. All of his argument to the contrary had only managed to demote him to lord. At least he thought it had. He had never seen quite so much bowing and scraping, even with Lord Aglamar. I need red saddle, Tima. He knew better than to offer to do it himself. Tima would not let Rand soil his hands. I thought I'd spend a few days seeing the country around the town. Once he was on the big bay stallion's back, a few days would see him at the River Erinin, or across the border into Arafel. They'll never find me then. The groom bent himself almost double and stayed bent.
Forgive, my lord, he whispered hoarsely. Forgive. But Tima cannot obey.
Flushing with embarrassment, Rand took an anxious look around. There was no one else in sight, then grabbed the man's shoulder and pulled him upright. He might not be able to stop Tima and a few others from acting like this, but he could try to stop anyone else from seeing it.
Why not, Tima? Tima, look at me, please. Why not? It is commanded, my lord,
Tima said, still whispering. He kept dropping his eyes, not afraid, but ashamed that he could not do what Rand asked.
Shinarans took shame the way other people took being branded a thief.
No horse may leave this stable until the order is changed. Nor any stable in the keep, my lord.
Rand had his mouth open to tell the man it was all right, but instead he licked his lips.
No horse from any stable?
Yes, my lord. The order came down only a short time ago. Only moments.
Dima's voice picked up strength.
All the gates are closed as well, my lord. None may enter or leave without permission. Not even the city patrol, so Tima has been told.
Rand swallowed hard, but it did not lessen the feeling of fingers clutching his windpipe.
The order, Tima. It came from Lord Agomar?
Of course, my lord. Who else? Lord Agomar did not speak the command to Tima, of course, nor even to the man who did speak it to Tima, but, my lord, who else could give such a command in Faldara?
Who else?
Rand jumped as the biggest bell in the keep bell tower let out a sonorous peal. The other bells joined in, then bells from the town.
If Tima may be bold, the groom called above the reverberations, my lord must be very happy.
Rand had to shout back to be heard.
Happy? Why? The welcome is finished, my lord.
Tima's gesture took in the bell tower.
The Amarlin seat will be sending for my lord and my lord's friends to come to her now.
Rand broke into a run. He just had time to see the surprise on Tima's face, and then he was gone. He did not care what Tima thought.
She will be sending for me now.
Chapter 3. Friends and Enemies. Rand did not run far, only as far as the sally gate around the corner from the stable. He slowed to a walk before he got there, trying to appear casual and unhurried. The arched gate was closed tight. It was barely big enough for two men to ride through abreast, but like all the gates in the outer wall, it was covered with broad strips of black iron and locked shut with a thick bar. Two guards stood before the gate in plain conical helmets and plate and mail armor with long swords on their backs. Their golden surcoats bore the black hawk on the chest.
He knew one of them slightly, Ragan.
The scar from a Trolloc arrow made a white triangle against Ragan's dark cheek behind the bars of his face guard. The puckered skin dimpled with a grin when he saw Rand.
Peace favor you, Randalthor.
Ragan almost shouted to be heard over the bells.
Do you intend to hit rabbits over the head, or do you still insist that club is a bow?
The other guard shifted to stand more in front of the gate.
Peace favor you, Ragan,
Rand said, stopping in front of them. It was an effort to keep his voice calm.
You know it's a bow. You've seen me shoot it.
No good from a horse,
the other guard said sourly. Rand recognized him now, with his deep-set, almost black eyes that never seemed to blink. They peered from his helmet like twin caves inside another cave. He supposed there could be worse luck for him than Massima guarding the gate, but he was not sure how, short of a red Aes Sedai.
It's too long, Massima added. I can shoot three arrows with a horse bow while you loose one with that monster.
Rand forced a grin, as if he thought it was a joke. Massima had never made a joke in his hearing, nor laughed at one. Most of the men at Faldara accepted Rand. He trained with Lan, and Lord Agomar had him at table. And most important of all, he had arrived at Faldara in company with Moraine, an Aes Sedai. Some seemed unable to forget his being an outlander, though, barely saying two words to him, and then only if they had to. Massima was the worst of those.
It's good enough for me, Rand said. Speaking of rabbits, Ragan, how about letting me out? All this noise and bustle is too much for me. Better to be out hunting rabbits even if I never see one.
Ragan half turned to look at his companion, and Rand's hopes began to lift. Ragan was an easygoing man, his manner belying his grim scar, and he seemed to like Rand. But Massima was already shaking his head. Ragan sighed.
It cannot be, Randalthor.
He gave a tiny nod toward Massima as if to explain, if it were up to him alone.
No one is to leave without a written pass. Too bad you did not ask a few minutes ago. The command just came down to bar the gates.
But why would Lord Agomar want to keep me in?
Massima was eyeing the bundles on Rand's back and his saddlebags. Rand tried to ignore him.
I'm his guest, he went on to Ragan. By my honor, I could have left any time these past weeks. Why would he mean this order for me?
It is Lord Agomar's order, isn't it? Massima blinked at that, and his perpetual frown deepened. He almost appeared to forget Rand's packs.
Ragan laughed. Who else could give such an order, Randall Thor? Of course, it was Uno who passed it to me, but whose order could it have been?
Massima's eyes, fixed on Rand's face, did not blink.
I just want to go out by myself, that's all, Rand said. I'll try one of the gardens then. No rabbits, but at least there won't be a crowd. The light illumine you, and peace favor you.
He walked away without waiting for an answering blessing, resolving not to go near any of the gardens on any account.
Burn me. Once the ceremonies are done, there could be Aes Sedai in any of them.
Aware of Massima's eyes on his back, he was sure it was Massima, he kept his pace normal. Suddenly the bells stopped ringing, and he skipped a step. Minutes were passing, a great many of them. Time for the Amarlin seat to be shown to her chambers. Time for her to send for him. To start a search when he was not found. As soon as he was out of sight of the sally gate, he began to run again. Near the barracks kitchens, the carter's gate, where all the foodstuffs for the keep were brought in, stood closed and barred behind a pair of soldiers. He hurried past, across the kitchen yard, as if he had never meant to stop. The dog gate at the back of the keep, just high enough and wide enough for one man on foot, had its guards too. He turned around before they saw him. There were not many gates, even as big as the keep was, but if the dog gate was guarded, they all would be. Perhaps he could find a length of rope. He climbed one of the stairs to the top of the outer wall, to the wide parapet with its crenellated walls. It was not comfortable for him being so high and exposed if that wind came again, but from there he could see across the tall chimneys and sharp roofs of the town all the way to the city wall. Even after nearly a month, the houses still looked odd to his Two Rivers eyes, eaves reaching almost to the ground, as if the houses were all wood-shingled roof and chimneys angled to let heavy snow slide past. A broad paved square surrounded the keep, but only 100 paces from the wall lay streets full of people going about their daily business, aproned shopkeepers out under the awnings in front of their shops, rough-clothed farmers in town to buy and sell, hawkers and tradesmen and townspeople gathered in knots, no doubt to talk about the surprise visit from the Amarlin seat. He could see carts and people flowing through one of the gates in the town wall. Apparently the guards there had no orders about stopping anyone. He looked up at the nearest guard tower. One of the soldiers raised a gauntleted hand to him. With a bitter laugh, he waved back. Not a foot of the wall but was under the eyes of guards. Leaning through an embrasure, he peered down past the slots in the stone for setting hoardings, down the sheer expanse of stone to the dry moat far below. 20 paces wide and 10 deep, faced with stone polished slippery smooth. A low wall slanted to give no hiding place, surrounded it to keep anyone from falling in by accident, and its bottom was a forest of razor-sharp spikes. Even with a rope to climb down and no guards watching, he could not cross that. What served to keep Trollocs out in the last extreme served just as well to keep him in. Suddenly he felt weary to the bone, drained. The Amarlin seat was there, and there was no way out. No way out, and the Amarlin seat there. If she knew he was there, if she had sent the wind that had seized him, then she was already hunting him, hunting with an Aes Sedai's powers. Rabbits had more chance against his bow. He refused to give up, though. There were those who said Two Rivers folk could teach stones and give lessons to mules. When there was nothing else left, Two Rivers people hung on to their stubbornness. Leaving the wall, he wandered through the keep. He paid no mind to where he went, so long as it was nowhere he would be expected. Not anywhere near his room, nor any of the stables, nor any gate. Massima might risk Uno's tongue to report him trying to leave, nor garden. All he could think of was keeping away from any Aes Sedai. Even Moraine. She knew about him.
Despite that, she had done nothing against him. So far. So far as you know. What if she's changed her mind? Maybe she's sent for the Ammerlin seat. For a moment, feeling lost, he leaned against the corridor wall, the stone hard under his shoulder. Eyes blank, he stared at a distant nothing and saw things he did not want to see. Gentled. Would it be so bad to have it all over? Really over? He closed his eyes, but he could still see himself huddling like a rabbit with nowhere left to run, and Aes Sedai closing around him like ravens. They almost always die soon after, men who've been gentled. They stop wanting to live. He remembered Tom Marilyn's words too well to face that. With a brisk shake, he hurried on down the hall. No need to stay in one place until he was found. How long till they find you, anyway? You're like a sheep in a pen. How long? He touched the sword hilt at his side. No, not a sheep. Not for Aes Sedai or anybody else. He felt a little foolish, but determined. People were returning to their tasks. A din of voices and clattering pots filled the kitchen that lay nearest the great hall, where the Ammerlin seat and her party would feast that night. Cooks and scullions and potboys all but ran at their work. The spit dogs trotted in their wicker wheels to turn the spitted meats. He made his way quickly through the heat and steam, through the smells of spices and cooking. No one spared him a second glance. They were all too busy. The back halls where the servants lived in small apartments were stirring like a kicked antheap as men and women scurried to don their best livery. Children did their playing in corners out of the way. Boys waved wooden swords and girls played with carved dolls, some announcing that hers was the Ammerlin seat. Most of the doors stood open, doorways blocked only by beaded curtains. Normally that meant whoever lived there was open to visitors, but today it simply meant the residents were in a hurry. Even those who bowed to him did so with hardly a pause. Would any of them hear, when they went to serve, that he was being sought, and speak of seeing him? Speak to an Aes Sedai and tell her where to find him? The eyes that he passed suddenly appeared to be studying him slyly, and to be weighing and considering behind his back. Even the children took on sharper looks in his mind's eye. He knew it was just his imagination. He was sure it was. It had to be. But when the servants' apartments were behind him, he felt as if he had escaped before a trap could spring shut. Some places in the keep were empty of people, the folk who normally worked there released for the sudden holiday. The armorer's forge, with all the fires banked, the anvils silent. Silent, cold, lifeless. Yet somehow not empty. His skin prickled, and he spun on his heel. No one there. Just the big square tool chests and the quenching barrels full of oil. The hair on the back of his neck stirred, and he whipped round again. The hammers and tongs hung in their places on the wall. Angrily, he stared around the big room. There's nobody there. It's just my imagination. That wind and the Ammerlin. That's enough to make me imagine things. Outside in the armorer's yard, the wind swirled up around him momentarily. Despite himself, he jumped, thinking it meant to catch him. For a moment, he smelled the faint odor of decay again and heard someone behind him laughing slyly. Just for a moment. Frightened, he edged in a circle, peering warily. The yard, paved with rough stone, was empty except for him. Just your bloody imagination. He ran away, and behind him he thought he heard the laughter again, this time without the wind. In the woodyard, the presence returned, the sense of someone there, the feel of eyes peering at him around tall piles of split firewood under the long sheds, darting glances over the stacks of seasoned planks and timbers waiting on the other side of the yard for the carpenter's shop, now closed up tight. He refused to look around, refused to think of how one set of eyes could move from place to place so fast, could cross the open yard from the firewood shed to the lumber shed without even a flicker of movement that he could see. He was sure it was one set of eyes. Imagination. Well, maybe I'm going crazy already. He shivered. Not yet. Light, please, not yet. Stiff-backed, he stalked across the woodyard, and the unseen watcher followed. Down deep corridors, lit only by a few rush torches, in the storerooms filled with sacks of dried peas or beans, crowded with slatted racks heaped with wrinkled turnips and beets, or stacked with barrels of wine and casks of salted beef and kegs of ale, the eyes were always there, sometimes following him, sometimes waiting when he entered. He never heard a footstep but his own, never heard a door creak except when he opened and closed it. But the eyes were there.
Light, I am going crazy.
Then he opened another storeroom door, and human voices, human laughter, drifted out to fill him with relief. There would be no unseen eye here. He went in. Half the room was stacked to the ceiling with sacks of grain. In the other half, a thick semicircle of men knelt in front of one of the bare walls. They all seemed to wear the leather jerkins and bowl-cut hair of menials. No warrior's topknots, no livery. No one who might betray him accidentally.
What about on purpose?
The rattle of dice came through their soft murmurs, and somebody let out a raucous laugh at the throw. Loyal was watching them dice, rubbing his chin thoughtfully with a finger thicker than a big man's thumb, his head almost reaching the rafters nearly two spans up. None of the dicers gave him a glance. Ogier were not exactly common in the Borderlands, or anywhere else, but they were known and accepted here, and Loyal had been in Faldara long enough to excite little comment. The Ogier's dark, stiff-collared tunic was buttoned up to his neck and flared below the waist over his high boots, and one of the big pockets bulged and sagged with the weight of something. Books, if Rand knew him. Even watching men gamble, Loyal would not be far from a book. In spite of everything, Rand found himself grinning. Loyal often had that effect on him. The Ogier knew so much about some things, so little about others, and he seemed to want to know everything. Yet Rand could remember the first time he ever saw Loyal, with his tufted ears and his eyebrows that dangled like long mustaches and his nose almost as wide as his face. Saw him and thought he was facing a Trolloc. It still shamed him. Ogier and Trollocs. Murdrol and things from the dark corners of midnight tales. Things out of stories and legends. That was how he had thought of them before he left Emmons Field. But since leaving home, he had seen too many stories walking in the flesh ever to be so sure again. Aes Sedai and unseen watchers and a wind that caught and held. His smile faded. All the stories are real, he said softly. Loyal's ears twitched and his head turned toward Rand. When he saw who it was, the Ogier's face split in a grin and he came over.
Ah, there you are.
His voice was a deep bumblebee rumble.
I did not see you at the welcome. That was something I had not seen before. Two things. The Shinaran welcome and the Amaran seat. She looks tired, don't you think? It cannot be easy being Amarlin. Worse than being an elder, I suppose.
He paused with a thoughtful look, but only for a breath.
Tell me, Rand, do you play at dice too? They play a simpler game here with only three dice. We use four in the steading. They won't let me play, you know. They just say glory to the builders and will not bet against me. I don't think that's fair, do you? The dice they use are rather small.
He frowned at one of his hands, big enough to cover a human head.
But I still think...
Rand grabbed his arm and cut him off.
The builders. Loyal. Ogier built Faldara, didn't they? Do you know any way out except by the gates? A crawl hole, a drain pipe, anything at all, if it's big enough for a man to wiggle through. Out of the wind would be good, too.
Loyal gave a pained grimace, the ends of his eyebrows almost brushing his cheeks.
Rand, Ogier built Mothel Dadaranel. But that city was destroyed in the Trolloc Wars. This,
he touched the stone wall lightly with broad fingertips,
was built by men. I can sketch a plan of Mothel Dadaranel. I saw the maps once in an old book in Steading Shangtai. But of Faldara, I know no more than you. It is well built, though, isn't it? Stark, but well made.
Rand slumped against the wall, squeezing his eyes shut.
I need a way out, he whispered. The gates are barred and they won't let anyone pass. But I need a way out.
But why, Rand? Loyal said slowly. No one here will hurt you. Are you all right, Rand?
Suddenly his voice rose.
Matt, Perrin, I think Rand is sick.
Rand opened his eyes to see his friends straightening up out of the knot of dicers. Matt Cawthon, long-limbed as a stork, wearing a half-smile as if he saw something funny that no one else saw. Shaggy-haired Perrin Ibarra, with heavy shoulders and thick arms from his work as a blacksmith's apprentice. They both still wore their Two Rivers garb, plain and sturdy, but travel-worn. Matt tossed the dice back into the semicircle as he stepped out, and one of the men called,
Here, Southlander, you can't quit while you're winning. Better than when I'm losing, Matt said with a laugh.
Unconsciously, he touched his coat at the waist, and Rand winced. Matt had a dagger with a ruby in its hilt under there, a dagger he was never without, a dagger he could not be without. It was a tainted blade from the dead city of Shadar Logoth, tainted and twisted by an evil almost as bad as the Dark One, the evil that had killed Shadar Logoth 2,000 years before, yet still lived among the abandoned ruins. That taint would kill Matt if he kept the dagger. It would kill him even faster if he put it aside.
You'll have another chance to win it back.
Wry snorts from the kneeling men indicated they did not think there was much chance of that. Perrin kept his eyes down as he followed Matt across to Rand. Perrin always kept his eyes down these days, and his shoulders sagged as if he carried a weight too heavy even for their width.
What's the matter, Rand?
Matt asked.
You're as white as your shirt. Hey, where did you get those clothes? You're turning Shinaran? Maybe I'll buy myself a coat like that and a fine shirt.
He shook his coat pocket, producing a clink of coins.
I seem to have luck with the dice. I can hardly touch them without winning.
You don't have to buy anything, Rand said tiredly. Moraine had all our clothes replaced. They're burned already for all I know.
Oh, but what you two are wearing.
Elan Su will probably be around to collect those too, so I'd change fast if I were you, before she takes them off your back. Perrin still did not look up, but his cheeks turned red. Matt's grin deepened, though it looked forced. They, too, had had encounters in the baths, and only Matt tried to pretend it did not matter.
And I'm not sick. I just need to get out of here. The Armelin seat is here. Lance said... He said with her here, it would be better for me if I were gone a week. I need to leave, and all the gates are barred.
He said that? Matt frowned.
I don't understand. He'd never say anything against an Aes Sedai. Why now?
Look, Rand, I don't like Aes Sedai any more than you do, but they aren't going to do anything to us. He lowered his voice to say that, and looked over his shoulder to see if any of the gamblers was listening. Feared the Aes Sedai might be, but in the Borderlands, they were far from being hated, and a disrespectful comment about them could land you in a fight or worse.
Look at Moraine. She isn't so bad, even if she is Aes Sedai.
You're thinking like old Sen Bui telling his tall tales back home in the Wine Spring Inn. I mean, she hasn't hurt us, and they won't. Why should they? Perrin's eyes lifted, yellow eyes gleaming in the dim light like burnished gold.
Moraine hasn't hurt us, Rand thought.
Perrin's eyes had been as deep a brown as Matt's when they left the Two Rivers. Rand had no idea how the change had come about. Perrin did not want to talk about it, or about very much of anything since it happened. But it had come at the same time as the slump in his shoulders, and a distance in his manner as if he felt alone, even with friends around him. Perrin's eyes and Matt's dagger. Neither would have happened if they had not left Emmons Field, and it was Moraine who had taken them away. He knew that was not fair. They would probably all be dead at Trolloc's hands, and a good part of Emmons Field as well if she had not come to their village. But that did not make Perrin laugh the way he used to, or take the dagger from Matt's belt.
And me, if I was home and still alive, would I still be what I am now? At least I wouldn't be worrying about what the Aes Sedai are going to do to me.
Matt was still looking at him quizzically, and Perrin had raised his head enough to stare from under his eyebrows. Loyal waited patiently. Rand could not tell them why he had to stay away from the Amalan seat. They did not know what he was. Lan knew, and Moraine, and Egwene and Nynaeve. He wished none of them knew, and most of all he wished Egwene did not. But at least Matt and Perrin, and Loyal too, believed he was still the same. He thought he would rather die than let them know, than see the hesitation and worry he sometimes caught in Egwene's eyes and Nynaeve's, even when they were trying their best.
"Somebody's watching me," he said finally, "following me. Only there's nobody there."
Perrin's head jerked up, and Matt licked his lips and whispered,
"A fade?"
"Of course not," Loyal snorted. "How could one of the Eyeless enter Faldara, town or keep? By law, no one may hide his face inside the town walls, and the lamplighters are charged with keeping the streets lit at night, so there isn't a shadow for a Murdral to hide in. It could not happen."
"Walls don't stop a fade," Matt muttered. "Not when it wants to come in. I don't know as laws and lamps will do any better."
He did not sound like someone who had half thought fades were only Gleeman's tales less than half a year before. He had seen too much, too.
"And there was the wind," Rand added.
His voice hardly shook as he told what had happened on the tower top. Perrin's fists tightened until his knuckles cracked.
"I just want to leave here," Rand finished. "I want to go south. Somewhere away. Just somewhere away."
"But if the gates are barred," Matt said, "how do we get out?" Rand stared at him.
"We?"
He had to go alone. It would be dangerous for anyone near him eventually. He would be dangerous, and even Moraine could not tell him how long he had.
"Matt, you know you have to go to Tar Valon with Moraine. She said that's the only place you can be separated from that bloody dagger without dying. And you know what will happen if you keep it."
Matt touched his coat over the dagger, not seeming to realize what he was doing.
"An Aes Sedai's gift is bait for a fish," he quoted. "Well, maybe I don't want to put the hook in my mouth. Maybe whatever she wants to do in Tar Valon is worse than if I don't go at all. Maybe she's lying. The truth an Aes Sedai tells is never the truth you think it is."
"You have any more old sayings you want to rid yourself of?" Rand asked. "A south wind brings a warm guest, a north wind an empty house. A pig painted gold is still a pig. What about talk shears no sheep? A fool's words are dust."
"Easy, Rand," Perrin said softly. "There is no need to be so rough."
"Isn't there? Maybe I don't want you two going with me, always hanging around, falling into trouble and expecting me to pull you out. You ever think of that? Burn me, did it ever occur to you I might be tired of always having you there whenever I turn around? Always there, and I'm tired of it."
The hurt on Perrin's face cut him like a knife, but he pushed on relentlessly.
"There are some here think I'm a lord. A lord. Maybe I like that. But look at you, dicing with stable hands. When I go by myself. You two can go to Tar Valon or go hang yourselves. But I leave here alone."
Matt's face had gone stiff, and he clutched the dagger through his coat till his knuckles were white.
"If that is how you want it," he said coldly. "I thought we were... However you want it, all Thor. But if I decide to leave at the same time you do, I'll go. And you can stand clear of me."
"Nobody is going anywhere," Perrin said, "if the gates are barred."
He was staring at the floor again. Laughter rolled from the gamblers against the wall as someone lost.
"Go or stay," Loyal said. "Together or apart, it doesn't matter. You are all three Tavirin. Even I can see it, and I don't have that talent. Just by what happens around you. And Moraine Sedai says it too."
Matt threw up his hands.
"No more, Loyal. I don't want to hear about that anymore."
Loyal shook his head.
"Whether you hear it or not, it is still true. The Wheel of Time weaves the pattern of the age, using the lives of men for thread. And you three are Tavirin, center points of the weaving."
"No more, Loyal."
"For a time, the wheel will bend the pattern around you three, whatever you do. And whatever you do is more likely to be chosen by the wheel than by you. Tavirin pull history along behind them and shape the pattern just by being, but the wheel weaves Tavirin on a tighter line than other men. Wherever you go, and whatever you do, until the wheel chooses otherwise, you will—
No more! Matt shouted. The men dicing looked around, and he glared at them until they bent back to their game.
I am sorry, Matt, Loyal rumbled. I know I talk too much, but I did not mean—
I'm not staying here, Matt told the rafters, with a big-mouthed ogier and a fool whose head is too big for a hat. You coming, Perrin?
Perrin sighed and glanced at Rand, then nodded. Rand watched them go with a stick caught in his throat.
I must go alone. Light, help me, I have to.
Loyal was staring after them too, eyebrows drooping worriedly.
Rand, I really didn't mean to.
Rand made his voice harsh.
What are you waiting for? Go on with them. I don't see why you're still here. You are no use to me if you don't know a way out. Go on. Go find your trees and your precious groves, if they haven't all been cut down. And good riddance to them if they have.
Loyal's eyes, as big as cups, looked surprised and hurt at first, but slowly they tightened into what almost might be anger. Rand did not think it could be. Some of the old stories claimed ogier were fierce, though they never said how exactly, but Rand had never met anyone as gentle as Loyal.
If you wish it so, Randalthor,
Loyal said stiffly. He gave a rigid bow and stalked away after Matt and Perrin. Rand slumped against the stacked sacks of grain.
Well,
a voice in his head taunted. You did it, didn't you?
I had to, he told it. I will be dangerous just to be around. Blood and ashes. I'm going to go mad and— No, no, I won't. I will not use the power, and then I won't go mad, and— But I can't risk it. I can't, don't you see?
But the voice only laughed at him.
The gamblers were looking at him, he realized. All of them, still kneeling against the wall, had turned to stare at him. Shinarans of any class were almost always polite and correct, even to blood enemies, and ogier were never any enemies of Shinar. Shock filled the gambler's eyes. Their faces were blank, but their eyes said what he had done was wrong. Part of him thought they were right, and that drove their silent accusation deep. They only looked at him, but he stumbled out of the storeroom as if they were chasing him. Numbly, he went down through the storerooms, hunting a place to secret himself until some traffic was allowed through the gates again. Then he could hide in the bottom of a victualler's cart, maybe, if they did not search the carts on the way out. If they did not search the storerooms, search the whole keep for him. Stubbornly, he refused to think about that. Stubbornly concentrated on finding a safe place. But every place he found, a hollow in a stack of grain sacks, a narrow alley along the wall behind some wine barrels, an abandoned storeroom half filled with empty crates and shadows, he could imagine searchers finding him there. He could imagine that unseen watcher, whoever it was, or whatever, finding him there too. So he hunted on, thirsty and dusty and with cobwebs in his hair. And then he came out into a dimly torchlit corridor, and Egwene was creeping along it, pausing to peer into the storerooms she passed. Her dark hair, hanging to her waist, was caught back with a red ribbon, and she wore a goose-gray dress in the Shinaran fashion, trimmed in red. At the sight of her, sadness and loss rolled over him, worse than when he had chased Matt and Perrin and Loyal away. He had grown up thinking he would marry Egwene one day. They both had. But now— She jumped when he popped out right in front of her, and her breath caught loudly, but what she said was,
So there you are. Matt and Perrin told me what you did, and Loyal. I know what you're trying to do, Rand, and it is plain foolish.
She crossed her arms under her breasts, and her big, dark eyes fixed him sternly. He always wondered how she managed to seem to be looking down at him. She did it at will, although she was only as tall as his chest, and 2 years younger besides.
Good, he said.
Her hair suddenly made him angry. He had never seen a grown woman with her hair unbraided until he left the Two Rivers. There, every girl waited eagerly for the women's circle of her village to say she was old enough to braid her hair. Egwene certainly had. And here she was with her hair loose except for a ribbon.
I want to go home and can't, and she can't wait to forget Emmons Field.
You go away and leave me alone, too. You don't want to keep company with a shepherd anymore. There are plenty of Aes Sedai here for you to moon around now. And don't tell any of them you saw me. They're after me, and I don't need you helping them.
Bright spots of color bloomed in her cheeks.
Do you think I would...
He turned to walk away, and with a cry she threw herself at him, flung her arms around his legs. They both tumbled to the stone floor, his saddlebags and bundles flying. He grunted when he hit, sword hilt digging into his side, and again when she scrabbled up and plopped herself down on his back as if he were a chair.
My mother, she said firmly, always told me the best way to learn to deal with a man was to learn to ride a mule. She said they have about equal brains most of the time. Sometimes the mule is smarter.
He raised his head to look over his shoulder at her.
Get off me, Egwene. Get off! Egwene, if you don't get off...
He lowered his voice ominously.
I'll do something to you. You know what I am.
He added a glare for good measure. Egwene sniffed.
You wouldn't if you could. You would not hurt anybody. But you can't anyway. I know you cannot channel the one power whenever you want. It just happens, and you cannot control it. So you are not going to do anything to me or anybody else. I, on the other hand, have been taking lessons with Moraine. So if you don't listen to some sense, Randall Thor, I might just set your britches on fire. I can manage that much. You keep on as you are and see if I cannot.
Suddenly, for just a moment, the torch nearest them on the wall flared up with a roar. She gave a squeak and stared at it, startled. Twisting around, he grabbed her arm, pulled her off his back, and sat her against the wall. When he sat up himself, she was sitting there across from him, rubbing her arm furiously.
You really would have, wouldn't you? He said angrily. You're fooling with things you don't understand. You could have burned both of us to charcoal. Men, when you cannot win an argument, you either run away or resort to force. Hold on there. Who tripped who? Who sat on who? And you threatened, tried, to...
He raised both hands.
No, you don't. You do this to me all the time. Whenever you realize the argument isn't going the way you want, suddenly we are arguing about something else completely. Not this time. I am not arguing, she said calmly, and I am not changing the subject either. What is hiding except running away? And after you hide, you'll run away for true. And what about hurting Matt and Perrin and Loyal? And me? I know why. You're afraid you will hurt somebody even worse if you let them stay near you. If you don't do what you shouldn't, then you don't have to worry about hurting anybody. All this running around and striking out, and you don't even know if there's a reason. Why should the Armelin, or any Aes Sedai but Moraine, even know you exist?
For a moment, he stared at her. The longer she spent with Moraine and Nynaeve, the more she took on their manner, at least when she wanted to. They were much alike at times, the Aes Sedai and the Wisdom, distant and knowing. It was disconcerting coming from Egwene. Finally, he told her what Lan had said.
What else could he mean?
Her hand froze on his arm, and she frowned with concentration.
Moraine knows about you, and she hasn't done anything. So why should she now? But if Lan...
Still frowning, she met his eyes.
The storerooms are the first place they will look, if they do look. Until we find out if they are looking, we need to put you somewhere they would never think of searching. I know. The dungeon.
He scrambled to his feet.
The dungeon? Not in a cell, silly. I go there some evenings to visit Padan Fain. Nynaeve does too. No one will think it odd if I go early today. In truth, with everybody looking to the Armelin, no one will even notice us. But Moraine... She doesn't go to the dungeons to question Master Fain. She has him brought to her. And she has not done that very much for weeks. Believe me, you'll be safe there.
Still, he hesitated.
Padan Fain. Why do you visit the peddler anyway? He's a dark friend, admitted out of his own mouth, and a bad one. Burn me, Egwene, he brought the Trollocs to Emmons Field. The Dark One's Hound, he called himself, and he has been sniffing on my trail since winter night. Well, he is safe behind iron bars now, Rand.
It was her turn to hesitate, and she looked at him, almost pleading.
Rand, he has brought his wagon into the Two Rivers every spring since before I was born.
He knows all the people I know, all the places. It's strange, but the longer he has been locked up, the easier in himself he has become. It's almost as if he is breaking free of the Dark One. He laughs again and tells funny stories about Emmons Field folk, and sometimes about places I never heard of before. Sometimes he is almost like his old self. I'd just like to talk to somebody about home. Since I've been avoiding you, he thought, and since Perrin's been avoiding everybody, and Matt's been spending all his time gambling and carousing. I shouldn't have kept to myself so much, he muttered, then sighed. Well, if Moraine thinks it's safe enough for you, I suppose it is safe enough for me. But there's no need for you to be mixed in it. Egwene got to her feet and concentrated on brushing off her dress, avoiding his eye. Moraine has said it's safe. Egwene? Moraine Sedai has never told me I could not visit Master Fane, she said carefully. He stared at her, then burst out. You never asked her. She doesn't know. Egwene, that's stupid. Padon Fane's a dark friend, and as bad as ever a dark friend was. He is locked in a cage, she said stiffly, and I do not have to ask Moraine's permission for everything I do. It is a little late for you to start worrying about doing what an Aes Sedai thinks, isn't it? Now, are you coming? I can find the dungeon without you. They are looking for me, or will be, and it won't do any good to be found with me. Without me, she said dryly, you'll likely trip over your own feet and fall on the Ammerlin seat's lap, then confess everything while trying to talk your way out of it. Blood and ashes. You ought to be in the women's circle back home. If men were all as fumble-footed and helpless as you seem to think, we'd never... Are you going to stand here talking until they do find you? Pick up your things, Rand, and come with me. Not waiting for an answer, she spun around and started off down the hall. Muttering under his breath, he reluctantly obeyed. There were a few people, servants mainly, in the back ways they took. But Rand had the feeling that they all took special notice of him. Not notice of a man burdened for a journey, but of him, Randall Thor in particular. He knew it was his imagination, he hoped it was, but even so he felt no relief when they stopped in a passageway, deep beneath the keep, before a tall door with a small iron grill set in it, as thickly strapped with iron as any in the outer wall. A clapper hung below the grill. Through the grill, Rand could see bare walls and two top-knotted soldiers sitting bareheaded at a table with a lamp on it. One of the men was sharpening a dagger with long, slow strokes of a stone. His strokes never faltered when Egwene rapped with the clapper, a sharp clang of iron on iron. The other man, his face flat and sullen, looked at the door as if considering, before he finally rose and came over. He was squat and stocky, barely tall enough to look through the cross-hatched bars.
What do you want? Oh, it's you again, girl. Come to see your dark friend? Who's that?
He made no move to open the door. He's a friend of mine, Changu. He wants to see Master Fane, too. The man studied Rand, his upper lip quivering back to bare teeth. Rand did not think it was supposed to be a smile.
Well, Changu said finally. Well, tall, aren't you? Tall, and fancy dressed for your kind. Somebody catch you young on the Eastern Marches and tame you?
He slammed back the bolts and yanked open the door.
Well, come in if you're coming.
He took on a mocking tone.
Take care not to bump your head, my lord.
There was no danger of that. The door was tall enough for Loyal. Rand followed Egwene in, frowning and wondering if this Changu meant to make some sort of trouble. He was the first rude Shinaran Rand had met, and even Massimo was only cold, not really rude. But the fellow just banged the door shut and rammed the heavy bolts home, then went to some shelves beyond the end of the table and took one of the lamps there. The other man never ceased stropping his knife, never even looked up from it. The room was bare except for the table and benches and shelves, with straw on the floor, and another iron-bound door leading deeper in.
You'll want some light, won't you? Changu said. In there in the dark with your dark friend, friend?
He laughed, coarse and humorless, and lit the lamp.
He's waiting for you.
He thrust the lamp at Egwene and undid the inner door almost eagerly.
Waiting for you. In there. In the dark.
Rand paused uneasily at the blackness beyond and Changu grinning behind, but Yiguang caught his sleeve and pulled him in. The door slammed, almost catching his heel. The latch bars clanged shut. There was only the light of the lamp, a small pool around them in the darkness.
"Are you sure he'll let us out?" he asked.
The man had never even looked at his sword or bow, he realized. Never asked what was in his bundles.
"They aren't very good guards.
We could be here to break Fane free for all he knows."
"They know me better than that," she said,
but she sounded troubled, and she added, "They seem worse every time I come."
"All the guards do. Meaner and more sullen.
Chenggu told jokes the first time I came, and Adao never even speaks anymore. But I suppose working in a place like this can't give a man a light heart."
"Maybe it's just me.
This place does not do my heart any good either." Despite her words, she drew him confidently into the black. He kept his free hand on his sword. The pale lamplight showed a wide hall, with flat iron grills to either side, fronting stone-walled cells. Only two of the cells they passed held prisoners. The occupants sat up on their narrow cots as the light struck them, shielding their eyes with their hands, glaring between their fingers. Even with their faces hidden, Rand was sure they were glaring. Their eyes glittered in the lamplight.
"That one likes to drink and fight," Egwene murmured, indicating a burly fellow with sunken knuckles. "This time, he wrecked the common room of an inn in the town single-handed and hurt some men badly."
The other prisoner wore a gold-embroidered coat with wide sleeves and low, gleaming boots.
"He tried to leave the city without settling his inn bill."
She sniffed loudly at that. Her father was an innkeeper as well as mayor of Emmonsfield.
"Nor paying half a dozen shopkeepers and merchants what he owed."
The men snarled at them, guttural curses as bad as any Rand had heard from merchants' guards.
"They grow worse every day, too," she said in a tight voice, and quickened her step.
She was enough ahead of him when they reached Padan Fane's cell at the very end that Rand was out of the light entirely. He stopped there, in the shadows behind her lamp. Fane was sitting on his cot, leaning forward expectantly as if waiting, just as Changu had said. He was a bony, sharp-eyed man with long arms and a big nose, even more gaunt now than Rand remembered. Not gaunt from the dungeon. The food here was the same as the servants ate, and not even the worst prisoner was shorted. But from what he had done before coming to Faldara. The sight of him brought back memories Rand would just as soon have done without. Fane on the seat of his big peddler's wagon, wheeling across the wagon bridge, arriving in Emmonsfield the day of winter night. And on winter night, the Trollocs came, killing and burning, hunting. Hunting three young men, Moraine had said. Hunting me, if they only knew it, and using Fane for their trailhound. Fane stood at Egwene's approach, not shielding his eyes or even blinking at the light. He smiled at her, a smile that touched only his lips, then raised his eyes above her head. Looking straight at Rand, hidden in the blackness behind the light, he pointed a long finger at him.
"I feel you there, hiding, Randall Thor," he said, almost crooning. "You can't hide. Not from me, and not from them. You thought it was over, did you not? But the battle's never done, Althor. They are coming for me, and they are coming for you, and the war goes on. Whether you live or die, it's never over for you. Never."
Suddenly he began to chant.
"Soon comes the day all shall be free, even you and even me. Soon comes the day all shall die. Surely you, but never I."
He let his arm fall, and his eyes rose to stare intently at an angle up into the darkness. A crooked grin twisting his mouth, he chuckled deep in his throat as if whatever he saw was amusing.
"Mordith knows more than all of you. Mordith knows."
Egwene backed away from the cell until she reached Rand, and only the edge of the light touched the bars of Fane's cell. Darkness hid the peddler, but they could still hear his chuckles. Even unable to see him, Rand was sure Fane was still peering off at nothing. With a shiver, he pried his fingers off his sword hilt.
"Light," he said hoarsely. "This is what you call being like you used to be?" Sometimes he's better and sometimes worse.
Egwene's voice was unsteady.
This is worse. Much worse than usual.
What is he seeing, I wonder? He's mad, staring at a stone ceiling in the dark. If the stone weren't there, he'd be looking straight at the women's apartments, where Moraine is, and the Armorland seat. He shivered again. He's mad. This is not a good idea, Rand.
Looking over her shoulder at the cell, she drew him away from it and lowered her voice as if afraid Fane might overhear. Fane's chuckles followed them.
Even if they don't look here, I cannot stay here with him like this, and I do not think you should either. There is something about him today that...
She drew a shaky breath.
There's one place even safer from search than here. I did not mention it before because it was easier to get you in here, but they will never look in the women's apartments. Never. The women's... Egwene, Fane may be mad, but you are madder. You can't hide from hornets in a hornet's nest. What better place? What is the one part of the keep no man will enter without a woman's invitation, not even Lord Agomar? What is the one place no one would ever think to look for a man? What is the one place in the keep sure to be full of Aes Sedai? It is crazy, Egwene.
Poking at his bundles, she spoke as if it were all decided.
You must wrap your sword and bow in your cloak, and then it will look as if you're carrying things for me. It should not be too hard to find you a jerkin and a shirt that isn't so pretty. You will have to stoop, though. I told you, I won't do it. Since you're acting stubborn as a mule, you should take right to playing my beast of burden. Unless you would really rather stay down here with him.
Fane's laughing whisper came through the black shadows.
The battle's never done, Althor. Mordeth knows.
I'd have a better chance jumping off the wall, Rand muttered.
But he unslung his bundles and set about wrapping sword and bow and quiver, as she had suggested. In the darkness, Fane laughed.
It's never over, Althor. Never.